This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Michael Hicks is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University, and he is also in his capacity there on campus as a member of the Ball State faculty, the George and Francis Ball Distinguished Professor of Economics out of the Miller College of Business on campus in Muncie. And Professor Hicks is with us once again to talk about Hoosier economics. And thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, it's a joy to be with you again.
Well, I know that you occasionally come out with an economic forecast, and you released, I guess, your look at how 2020 seems to shape up around the Hoosier State and the U.S. economy as well. How did you first come up with what you put out there? How did you do your models, or which models do you rely on when it's time to take a look at whether the economy in Indiana or the country is growing or if it's not growing?
That's a great question, and I could make it extraordinarily boring and lengthy. I use two models. One is a model of the national economy that's published by Ray Fair out of Yale. And that model gives us a national forecast. And you can simulate, you know, changes to monetary policy or fiscal stimulus in the future with that. So it's a model that's updated on data every quarter. And I use that for the U.S. forecast. And I usually tweak it a little bit with projections of different changes to policy. And then I've written my own model of the U.S. of the Midwestern states using the national economy as a predictor. And those then allow me to predict into the future what is likely to be the case given the history of the GDP growth, employment, those sorts of things in the past. And so that's all it is. It's a forecast. Forecasts are always wrong. They get more wrong the farther out you go, but hopefully they're right enough to be useful for people who are looking at public policy or planning their business.
I would imagine that it's pretty tough to try to do a forecast, even if you have really, really good data to work with. And I imagine it's particularly tough if you're trying to forecast for an entire year.
Well, it's not hard to forecast. It's hard to forecast and be kind of predictably right.
Yeah.
And so what we do spend an awful lot of time building these models and then going back and evaluating them. I use a version of the same model that I've been using since the end of the recession that we tested each year to see how the performance was. And it's generally pretty good. I'll say that economists are really poor at predicting turning points in the economy. So, moving out of a recession or moving into a recession, our models just aren't very good at it, which is unfortunate because that would be something of key importance to everyone, I think. So I don't want to oversell the accuracy. The thing that I will say about this year that makes it different from most other years is that there's extraordinary consensus on what growth looks like for the next year or two. Not a lot of different takes out there among people who are in the professional forecasting business and in academia.
Now, I know I want to find out more about Indiana in particular, at least a clue as to how Northwest Indiana's economy is going to shape up going into 2020. And we've talked about this before in some of our past conversations this year. But let's look first here at the big picture, the U.S. economy. How do things seem to look as far as the forecast and all the other data and the indications that you've got so far?
Well, let me start by backing up. The first half of 2018 was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Tax Cut and Jobs Act came in. Growth hit, well over 3% for an average of a couple of quarters. Things looked good, and then in the second half of 2018, things started to slow. By winter of 2019, growth in the U.S. economy really started to slow. Employment here in Indiana peaked over the winter, and since then, things have been much more sluggish. We're down about 10,000 factory jobs, about 12,000 total jobs this year since our peak earlier this year. And so that, which is playing out throughout the Midwest, a very similar story is what we project going forward nationally, which is growth that has slipped from high 2% 18 months ago to around 2% now to being under 2%. So I'm projecting to start the year 1.9% growth and GDP slipping to 1.7% growth. So that probably will translate into employment numbers in the 140,000-150,000 a year, which is still solid labor market growth, but certainly not the you know, gangbusters growth that we should hope for in a long recovery.
I know that the, in your column that's out here recently talking about some of the problems, I guess, of looking to the past, in particular for people that are trying to see if there's some correlation, I guess, between some of the changes that were made during President Obama's administration and going into the President Trump administration now, that you can't really compare much because it's kind of dangerous to do so. You don't always come up with the correct data, do you?
Right. The point I was trying to make in the column is, and as we moved into the Great Recession, three things happened. We had a big quantitative easing by the Federal Reserve, and the Feds are independent, so they're doing their thing. Interest rates at the time, at the beginning of 2008, which was the beginning of a recession, and even at the beginning of 2009, are still higher than they are today. And we didn't have quite as much Fed quantitative easing or big Fed balance sheet, which stimulates the economy. At the same time, Congress passed a couple of bailout bills. The first one was the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or the stimulus package, passed in February 2009. And then the big three turned out to be big two auto bailout, which is about $26 billion. And it ended up about half of that was paid back. So that's where we were back in 2009, at the sort of darkest days of the Great Recession. Today, we're 127 months into the longest recovery in American history, and the deficit is $1.1 trillion. So we just came through a bigger effective stimulus package than we had at the darkest days of the Great Recession. The bailout for farmers is now about $30 billion, which is actually bigger than the GM and Fiat Chrysler bailout turned out to be. And the Federal Reserve interest rates and their quantitative easing is like it was at about the time of the bank bailouts in late 2008-2009. So absent a TARP, which was almost all paid back, 100% paid back, which was to stabilize banks, we're living in an environment today where we're stimulating the economy through federal spending, through monetary policy, and through targeted bailouts more aggressively than we did in 2009, when people were going wild and the Tea Party was born and we were all concerned about the path of the U.S. economy. So whatever you think about how good the economy is today, you have to think about what we're doing to try to prop it up at a time when we should be running budget surpluses. We should not be bailing out, we've been in recovery for a decade. Why are we bailing out farmers? Well, bad public policy has led to those problems. So that's where we are today.
Now, let's take a look here first at Indiana. How do we seem to shape up, from what you can tell right now, with all the models that you have and with the data that you have to work with, too? How do we shape up in Indiana for 2020 as the forecast seems to go right now?
Right. I have us slowing down a little bit more precipitously than the U.S. has, mostly because we're so manufacturing intensive. So I have growth coming in at 1.6% in first quarter, then 1.4 for second, 1.5, 1.4 for the rest of the year. So I think we're going to end the year growing at about 1.5%, which is about a quarter to a half percent slower than I expect the nation to grow. And I think that's really as a consequence of the slowdown right now is mostly involving the manufactured goods. It's not affecting services, Netflix and all that other stuff. So we're seeing a very targeted problem that's going to hit Indiana, I think, much more than the rest of the nation as a whole.
How about wage growth? Are we making any making any improvements, or does it look like in 2020 that we're going to do some maybe some increase, or maybe at least not much of a change at all?
There are some areas that are very bright. If you're in a big urban area, so if you're Northwest Indiana and you're around Illinois, even though it's losing factory jobs, is expected to grow a little bit better simply because that big urban places are growing. And here in Indiana, 100% of all the growth in the state is being absorbed by Central Indiana, right? And a couple other urban places. So those places feel nothing. If you're in the metropolitan area of Indianapolis, you feel nothing. If you're in a suburban part of Lake Lake or Porter County, you don't feel anything. If unfortunately for Northwest Indiana, you also have, you know, a fair amount of jobs still tied up with heavy manufacturing and steel and elsewhere. So those neighborhoods are feeling a bit of the idling right now. Certainly steel is down and you know, all of the things that contribute to the production of automobiles and those sorts of things are down.
So I imagine it's pretty tough to probably try and come up with a good forecast that's going to stick, I suppose, a very reliable one, certainly locally, but for much of Indiana here, because it's so hard to tell what's going to happen around the country, won't it?
Right. We're living in what I would call a very acute policy environment. And normally, if you want to be, you know, the goal is to be as right as we can with these forecasts, but the challenges are, you know, the Federal Reserve could change its policy outlook very quickly. Congressional votes to spend more money in target areas or a farm bailout could change things profoundly. And so you always have those as a backdrop. That's why I think economists are, you know, always cautious not to oversell this, or at least talk about where it may be a little bit pessimistic or optimistic. And so, and then I would also say the farther out you go, the worse the data is, you know, going to be able to speak to the conditions today. And then the more local you get, the more uncertain the data are, because they continue to be updated over several months, sometimes more than a year for a county or a small metro area data.
We haven't seen very much yet, and I know we'll probably see more when Congress finally does finish up voting on the spending plans that they finally reached, and in turn, if the administration doesn't change their minds and go ahead and improve things. How do you think that it's going to shape up as far as, if not Indiana economy, but the nation economy is going to be when the federal budget finally gets put into place and we go into 2020 and not have to worry about a shutdown of some kind?
Right. Shutdowns are very tough. They're isolated and tough, and they give at least the appearance of confusion in areas that people care an awful lot about if you're trying to get regulatory policy passed, that sort of thing. So just work through EPA. Shutdowns are uniquely bad form of governance. But, you know, I think right now the current budget proposal, insofar as I understand it, doesn't change very much. There's not a lot of extra spending. But it's just certain to go forward with what it is. So I don't see, you know, vast new defense programs being opened. I don't see new social programs being heavily funded, or we don't have a transportation or infrastructure bill that might lead to a big surge of construction spending across the country. But I think the bigger challenge is, you know, what's going to happen on the trade front. The USMCA and hopefully will make it more certain to engage in trade with our biggest partners, Mexico and Canada. It doesn't really change NAFTA, but it takes the fear of disruption off the table. And then the bigger question is, you know, what happens with the trade war with China? We hear murmurings of some sort of deal, but the actual numbers look like it's not going to be important at all. So if it changes radically, then my forecast would be terribly, I mean, things get a lot better on trade, then my forecast is going to be fairly pessimistic, right? We could see a much bigger improvement, and if it gets worse, then my forecast likely to be optimistic. And I hope that's not the case, because it's not a very good forecast.
So it seems like, I guess maybe for the automakers, it might be more promising for them, because as you say, with the U.S. MCA passed and put into effect, then we know that. So the worries about being able to handle the bits and pieces of everything that gets put into a car, for example, that has to trade borders from U.S. to Mexico in particular, you don't have that worry. It was sort of abated, probably not completely. I'm sure something will happen, but at least, you know, there won't be no big worries about that, huh?
Right, that's my hope. And there are like 30,000 parts of a car, and typically in the assemblies move across the borders, international borders, several times, and maybe across the U.S.-Mexico border four or five times before they finally end up in an assembly plant and then being, you know, shipped to a retailer or a dealer. So anything that interrupts that trade, anything that gives pause, anything that makes that event be taxed more heavily are going to be weighing heavily on manufacturing. And then globally, all of that supply chain adjustment means firms are spending real money to move their factories from China to Vietnam, you know, or China to South Korea or Taiwan. And none of those things are costless. They're all a negative effect on value. So at the end of the day, the impact of a trade war isn't just the collection of tariffs. It's all this other disruption. And that's kind of what's causing problems in Germany and France and Great Britain. They're like us. They're very deeply globalized around the world. And so if your factories are moving and they're idle and all this is going on, it tends to increase uncertainty and make it harder to justify the extra spending on new plant and equipment or new fleet or, you know, all those things come to get together to cause this global manufacturing slowdown.
Well, it sounds like overall, I guess we have not glowing improvements to come ahead, no terrible things. So I guess we may not expect maybe like a diamond ring in the stocking, but we're not going to get a huge amount of coal in the stocking this time around, eh?
Correct. That's what it looks like. Yeah. I mean, there are, the bright news are wages are continuing to rise. They've been, unfortunately, highest for the very highest 20% of households grew last year, about 9%. In the lowest 20% saw negative growth. Everybody else was about 4.5%. And so faster than inflation for households, but nothing that's, you know, going to set the world afire across the board in consumption. Jobs are plentiful. You can get a job if you want a job. They're not always great jobs, but if you're thoughtful and you know, work through getting that job and getting extra skills or education, there's something out for you. And that really helps modify the downturn in manufacturing. The only other thing I'll point out is the manufacturing is now, you know, 7-8% of the U.S. labor force. You know, back when I had brown hair and was young, it was a third of the labor force. And so, you know, back then, if we had a little manufacturing hiccup, the whole country got sick and Congress intervened and we saw all kinds of things to make the economy do better. Today, manufacturing employment is just not big enough to cause that same disruption. So the urgency in California or Massachusetts or Virginia to do something about the economy is significantly dampened. And that leaves the rest of us who are still have manufacturing, you know, 17-18% of our economy are feeling the pain more exaggerated form than the folks do elsewhere.
Well, Professor Hicks, thank you for spending time with us to talk about these issues. As you say, it can gets pretty wonky if you're not careful. And we're glad you're able to explain it in simple language for us. And we hope that you all at the Center for Business and Economic Research there and the Muncie campus will have a great holiday and a good 2020 coming up.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Professor Michael Hicks is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And with another edition of Green Fleet Radio, here is Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Mr. Mark Rowe, Senior Manager for Business Development at Trillium. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Carl. Happy to be here.
So for those who don't know about Trillium, can you give us a sense of what the company does?
Trillium is a leading provider of renewable fuels and alternative fueling stations in markets and fuels like compressed natural gas, you know, commonly referred to as CNG, hydrogen, electric charging, and solar. We specialize in fuel supply, design, and installation and operations of those alternative fuel stations. And our core customers are, we really run the gamut of fleets, from municipal fleets to transit buses, you know, all the way to trucking and refuse customers. So we work with them all.
So how rare is it for a company to build, maintain, and operate alternative fueling stations?
It's, you know, rare in the grand scheme of transportation and fuel. You know, I would say that alternative fuels is still relatively new. In fact, you know, engine technology and availability in the heavy duty segment really makes, if you look at a fuel like CNG, really only about 10 years new, if you think about some of the heavy duty engines that are available on the market today and are continually improving. But back to your question, not many companies really cover the entire supply chain in the alt fuel spectrum like Trillium. It's a service that we offer our customers, so they don't really have to go out and work with, you know, multiple vendors and contractors when it comes to integrating, you know, alternative fueling stations into their fleet operations. And that can look a couple different ways. You know, it could be a behind-the-gate private fueling solution for their alternative fuel of choice, or it could be, you know, leveraging the Love network and working with some of the real estate that we have at our disposal at Trillium.
So as you just mentioned, the Love's travel stops, I know our listeners are very well aware who Love's is. So how did that relationship benefit your customer?
Love's is a very big name in transportation. You know, Love's Travel Stops itself has about 500 locations nationwide, and they're continuing to grow. I think average the last few years, opening about 30 or more truck stops every year.
Wow.
As the professional drivers and the traveling public continue to hit the road, you know, their frequency of seeing Love's locations continues to increase. And, you know, Trillium is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Love's family of companies. So we plug right into the enterprise and, again, have access to that real estate. If there's an alternative fuel need for a fleet, that we could look at a Love's location to utilize. Alternatively, we can, again, work at behind-the-gate solution for a fleet to have depot charging or fuel at a terminal for some of those professional fleets out there. But certainly a lot of advantages being under Love from a professional standpoint, and we can pass a lot of those on to our customers in the transportation space.
So I know, as you explained, Trillium has rapidly evolved from solely being a compressed natural gas company to where you are today. So why do you think that is?
CNG is certainly a core part of our business, and really it's where our roots come from. We've been in business nearly 30 years now. Why CNG in the past, and why diversification forward? So the CNG piece is, it's easy for me, but it never hurts to say it. Those maybe not as familiar with it. You know, natural gas is an abundant domestic fuel. We have a large quantity here in the United States. It's an affordable fuel that has really found its sweet spot in transportation. Why have we expanded past CNG is simply the market is demanding it. CNG has really found its foothold, and it's a technology that is here today. It's available today for all market segments, light, medium, and heavy duty. And we see a lot of investment and effort continuing in natural gas, but also really a lot of excitement and focus on electric transportation going forward. And that's not new for the light duty segment, but certainly seems to have a lot of momentum in the heavy duty space, along with hydrogen. We're really excited about hydrogen as well. Hydrogen is a zero emission fuel. It has the ability to replicate that diesel-like fast fill experience, similar to a selling point like natural gas is, where you can get those trucks and buses back on the road quickly. So we see a lot of excitement in hydrogen, especially with transit operators. In fact, we'll soon be opening the nation's largest hydrogen station in California within days.
Congratulations. So can you tell our listeners, what are some of the environmental benefits of hydrogen fueling?
Hydrogen is absolutely a zero-emission fuel. If you think about the transit space, how many millions of people ride public transportation every day? By implementing hydrogen buses, and modes of transportation, you're really impacting the emissions profile of those vehicles for those cities that have air quality issues or are certainly interested in environmental improvement.
Where do you think Trillium and Love see the future of alternative fuels? Where's it going?
We see it going up and expanding. The way we look at our position in the marketplace is to be a comprehensive solution provider for the fuel of choice for our customers. And you could say that easier by saying, we really look at our value proposition as one partner, any fuel. We want to work with fleets considering alternative fuels that already have alternative fuels in their portfolio or a combination of the two and try to find solutions that make sense for them, that we can rely on our history of solid project performance, implementation, and again, leveraging the network of a broader and larger company that has real estate available for some of those heavy-duty on-highway applications. Well, mm-hmm. I think the future is bright, and look forward to being a partner for those fleets that are considering or are new to alternative fuels. We're happy to have a conversation and see where it goes.
So how can people learn more about Trillium?
You can hop on our website, trilliumcng.com. If they prefer, just reach out to me directly. The easiest way is probably to just get me by email, mdrowe@trilliumcng.com.
Well, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Mark Rowe, Senior Manager for Business Development at Trillium. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is supported by South Shore Clean Cities and by the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. The National Collegiate Athletic Association's opened the door for student athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness. A lot of the discussion is focusing around high-profile stars, but that's just a small fraction of student athletes who are affected by the NCAA rules. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton tells us that these proposed changes by the Indianapolis-based organization could go well beyond just deals and endorsements.
Right now, NCAA rules prevent student athletes from making money in all kinds of ways, including profiting off their own businesses, unless they receive a waiver. Former Texas A&M cross-country athlete Ryan Trahan learned that lesson the hard way. A couple years ago, his eligibility was revoked after he promoted his water bottle company on his YouTube channel that also highlighted his time as a Division I athlete.
Basically, I have to hide the fact that I own this company that I'm so proud of and have worked so hard on. And the other option is I can promote it all I want, but I can't let anyone know that I run cross-country and track for Texas A&M.
That's Trahan in one of his online videos. At the time, he said he was left with a decision he felt was unfair.
When you have to follow rules that you don't agree with and rules that you think are ethically wrong, it's just so frustrating.
Those rules could be changing. The NCAA board recently recommended an overhaul that would roll back some of the restrictions on what student athletes can earn. The NCAA, headquartered in Indianapolis, didn't respond to a request for an interview. Morgan Chall is a former college gymnast and now chairs the NCAA Division I Student Athlete Advisory Committee. With this announcement, she says athletes may not have to make the choice Trahan had to.
And what this means is, in terms of entrepreneurship and professional development, if I wanted to publish my own book or start my own business, I would be able to do so. I just wouldn't be able to accept any compensation for it so long as I'm a student athlete.
And now with social media and technology, rules made decades ago need to be updated. She says the change will not affect just elite athletes receiving endorsements. It will allow all student athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness.
Which are the issues that 98% of student athletes really face with, honestly, not even 98%, I'd say 100% of student athletes face with the current rules.
Including student athletes at the University of Evansville in Southern Indiana. The volleyball team at the Division I school plays against conference opponent Bradley University on a recent evening. Athletic Director Mark Spencer stands to the side of the court watching the game. After years of conversation about the NCAA rules, he's waiting to see a final outline of the rule change, but generally supports the concept. He says he and other athletic directors and schools want to give students a chance to create and promote their own businesses, as long as there are boundaries.
We hate having to have student athletes be separated any more than they are from being a normal student. So if normal students can profit from it, then why not the student athletes?
It will be at least many months before the rules might change. But with a growing number of states considering legislation to force the issue, many say change is inevitable. Josh Boyd is a professor at Purdue University's Brian Lamb School of Communication and has written about the NCAA and the business of amateur athletics. Boyd says the rule change will transform college sports. But he says any implementation will be complicated, and he fears it could widen the separation between student athletes in higher and lower profile sports.
And I know that's one of the things that the NCAA has talked about, being a disadvantage of paying players or having any kind of compensation for athletes, is that it would widen that divide.
Morgan Chall with the Student Athlete Advisory Committee agrees and says without clear guidelines, allowing student athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness could do more harm than good.
No one's talking about how any of these proposals are going to impact limited resource institutions or historically black universities and colleges or international student athletes. And it could really limit the future opportunities for all of those groups of people.
Each of the three divisions under the NCAA will meet and establish rules within the guidelines the NCAA creates with a target start date in 2021. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
As we head for 2020, a time for goal setting, whether it's New Year's resolutions or goals that we can keep and have others keep for a long term, and in particular for our youngsters, trying to help them set goals and to reach those goals. For that, let's turn to Tammy Silverman. She's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And as always, Tammy, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an interesting topic to start 2020 out, talking in January and in December about these particular goals. What kinds of things do parents and others who keep close tabs on young people need to do to help youngsters set those goals and to be able to keep them?
Well, first and foremost, it's important that the kids drive the goal-setting process, right? You may be thinking that you want your child or the child that you're working with or your mentee or whatever that is to maybe work on, their basketball, their reading, and, spending less time on electronics. But you know, it's really important for them to define what their goals are, because as we know, even as adults, if somebody sets a goal for you, it's not nearly as effective if you set and own that goal yourself.
What are some of the ways that the IYI supports educators as well as adults in general to be able to help get youngsters, first off, I guess, looking to set goals and then, of course, on achieving them?
Well, first and foremost, it's always good to talk to kids about reflecting on what's going on and what do they feel confident in, what would they learn, what would they like to do better, what else would they like to learn. It's important to set those habits of reflection and self-improvement, right, because that will set the pathway for them to do that through the rest of their life, which is actually called a growth mindset, right? We want everyone to constantly be looking at, what can I do better? How can I continue to succeed and learn? So it's important to do that with little kids. And in fact, the research says you can start setting goals with children as young as 3 or 4, but you really have to be age appropriate, right? So for little kids, it may be I will plus what they want to do. I will practice tying my shoes 5 times a day. I will memorize my addition facts by practicing every other day, something like that. And then as they grow older, those goals become more complex. And again, the more specific, the better.
Now, there are probably several approaches for adults to be able to help set goals and help young people set and achieve those goals, actually. What are some of the ways that parents can, what sources can they turn to if they have to have questions or whatever to be able to help get them moving along that direction?
Certainly. So Psychology Today has a model, I guess, that they call the ABCs of goal setting for kids. It's really very simple. The A is that it needs to be achievable, the B is believable, and the C is that it has to involve their personal commitment. So again, your child may say, I want to become, you know, the best basketball player in you know, the greater Chicagoland area. That may or may not be realistic for your child. So it's important that you really narrow it down and talk to them about what would it take to get there. So what they can achieve and what is believable is maybe they're going to go out and practice for half an hour every night. Maybe they're going to read a little bit more. Maybe they're going to research and explore some place they would like to visit. Whatever it is, their personal interest, it's up to us as adults to make sure that we're shaping it in a way that they can actually be successful.
Now, I guess if as an adult, ask a youngster, what do you want to do this year? What are some of the ways, some formulas maybe there might be out there that will help the youngsters move that direction?
Well, it's good to talk to them about categories. You know, what do they want to achieve in school or academically, and have them talk about a couple of things. What might they want to achieve in their pastimes, whether that be music or sports or crafts or whatever that is? You know, and then this one area I don't think we think about all the time is, what do they want to achieve as being a good citizen, right? And this is what they call character goals.
Uh-huh.
And teaching kids to be we thinkers instead of what are called me thinkers. So we instead of me, talking to them about maybe they want to reach out to some of their neighbors. Maybe they want to call their grandparents a little bit more. Maybe they want to volunteer at the local soup kitchen or sorting cans or cleaning up the sidewalks around their school, whatever those things are. So really talking in each of those categories. So academic, pastimes, and character goals.
Now, I imagine, too, that probably within the goal-setting process for young people, not only are there academic goals or intellectual goals, perhaps the youngsters may want to set for themselves, but they probably should have some time to be kids, too, at least, and there probably some goals to be able to reach that. How would you do that?
Yes, you know, and you're right on target there, Chris. One of the things that again, in doing a lot of this research, they said kids are so overscheduled that one of their goals may, in fact, be to have free time. Right, and to have more free time and downtime where they're just unscheduled and having fun and being kids, exactly that. It seems kind of strange that we might have to set that as a goal, but truly, for many of our kids, that's a realistic goal for them, is to make some downtime in their day so that they're not jumping from one thing to another to another.
I know there have been, of course, some great examples in history of people that we have probably all known about, learned about in school. When you get to that point, when you learn about these people by reading their books or in history class, in particular, people like Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Edison. There are people like that who have probably some goals that, of course, they've set for their lives and they've achieved those goals. How can you be able to translate that into something that you can talk with young people about?
Yes. Well, those are all great examples of people that obviously have achieved enormous success, but at the same time, they've all had setbacks as well. So it's really important in talking about goal setting with kids that we say those setbacks and those failures are absolutely normal and that everybody experiences them. So whether you're talking about one of those great inventors, whether you're talking about a civic leader like Benjamin Franklin, or whether you're talking about athletes, right? I know Michael Jordan is famous for talking about how many shots he missed and all of those things and how many games he lost on the way to being a big success. It's really important for kids to see that connection between goals, failure, and success. They all go together.
Now, if there are parents or other adults out there that are helping young people and getting a little advice necessary, where can they turn online or elsewhere to be able to find out more information about these items we've talked about?
Certainly. Well, all this information is at IYI.org, and it talks about those goal-setting ABCs and some tips to help your kids set some achievable, believable, and realistic goals for the coming year.
Tammy Silverman is president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Lake Area United Way is continuing to help families here in Northwest Indiana through its mission and its programs. And one of the programs during this time of year is Santa's Workshop for Working Families. And with us to tell us more about the event and how the programs overall are going, we have Brandy Adams. She's the Director of Resource Development for the Lake Area United Way, which is based in Griffith. And thanks for being with us today, Brandy.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit how the Santa's Workshop for Working Families got started, and tell us more about what happened this year, the event that just happened here on the 15th.
Yeah, so a few years ago, Lake Area United Way started a transition from what we call your grandfather's United Way, which is a traditional model of going out and raising money from organizations and donors in our areas, and then farming that money out through a variety of grants to local nonprofits. And what we saw time after time again is, although we were helping get families out of emergency situations that they were in, we weren't really giving them the tools and resources they needed to build themselves a path out of being in that position over and over again. So we wanted to create some programming and resources that would be available to families who are working. They are making just above the poverty level income, which for a family of four is right around the $25,000 mark. They're not qualified for the majority of social services that are out there because most of those go off of that poverty level line, but they're making far below what they need to make to actually survive and pay for their basic necessities here in Lake County. So that has been our main focus as a whole organization, is helping those families. And that's what we call, the acronym for it is ALICE, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. And in Lake County, we have about one in four families that fall into that category. So a few years ago, when we started to make this transition, we had a series of stories in the Times that showed that highlighted a few families in the area who were currently going through this struggle. And we had an anonymous donor who came in and said, here's a check. I want you to do something special for as many families as you can in Lake County for Christmas. And that's when Santa's Workshop was born. So this year we had it, like you said, this past Sunday on the 15th. We hosted it at Wicker Park. Frank Mervan is gracious and works with us and donates the space for us to use for that event. And we hosted about 24 families. We had 41 kids in all who were there. And each kid received a bag of Christmas presents. They did arts and crafts that were keepsakes, so a lot of like fingerprint paintings and things along that line that parents could keep for years to come. And then we also had a nice meal with them that included dessert and drinks and just a lot of fun time and conversation for families to bond and just have a good time without the worry of how are they going to provide some gifts for their kids Christmas morning.
That's great. Now, how are things going to fit in with, since we go from Christmas and the fact that we're helping families that need a little extra help during the holidays, how do we go into the continuation of the programs going into 2020 that fit all together with the Lake Area United Way?
The majority of the families who participated in our Santa's Workshop are also working with a woman here at Lake Area United Way that is a position that's been created called the Family Career Navigator. So this Family Career Navigator works with these families to determine what their goals are, where they currently are, and helps them build the path of how to get to where they want to be. And really is focusing on moving these families into jobs that pay a better wage. And the ultimate goal is to move them into a livable wage job so that these families can become financially stable and not need these type of resources. So the families who attended Sunday's workshop all pretty much work with her on some level of trying to better their current situation, whether that's they need to enroll in a school program to complete a certification to get a better paying job, or a lot of them just don't know what options are out there and what even the first step would be to take to move into that better paying job. And Talisa Rogers Hall is the name of our Family Career Navigator. She works with them to help make that happen.
Well, Brandy, thank you for spending time with us to talk about, first off, about the Santa's Workshop for Working Families that was just held over at Wicker Park in Highland, but a clue that these families that are had a chance to enjoy the holiday that they may not otherwise have had a chance to enjoy will continue on, and there's their help, and the Lake Area United Way is going to continue to help them. Thank you for being with us to talk about the programs coming up in 2020 as well.
Thank you again for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Brandy Adams is the Director of Resource Development for the Lake Area United Way, which is based in Griffith. The Griffith Police Department is not unique in having social workers on the department staff. Erica Rios tells us that she took advantage of some personal trauma to help steer her life in that career direction, and it's a career that she says is challenging and satisfying.
I think that what led me to social work was just life. I think most people in this profession, something led them to it, to want to help people. In my particular circumstance, I really think that helping people has always been something I was interested in doing, but particularly back in 2003, my first husband was killed in Iraq, and it was a really tough time in my life, and I think at that moment in time, it being the beginning of the war, and a lot of people really weren't sure what to do. It had been a long time since there were mass casualties and notifications. Mm-hmm. I kind of fell through a lot of the cracks. And so not having anyone to turn to really sparked my interest in being that person people turned to when they were experiencing a crisis in their life.
In particular, it drew you, I guess, to the law enforcement side, so to speak, and the fact that people that end up being involved one way or the other with the police oftentimes need some kind of help?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. And I think because this is an interesting arena for people, you know, police officers, first responders in general, you know, they come across people in times of need and crisis. And it's hopefully been a good tool for them to be able to use someone like me or with this background, you know, in their work.
How did it seem to fit when you got involved working here in particular with mm-hmm. the Griffith Police Department as to how you fit into the overall organization of the police department? Because police departments are always be known for having social workers, even though they are officers end up being social workers, I guess, on the spot, don't they?
Sure, absolutely. They're always referring people to services and things that they need, making suggestions and giving guidance. So how I fit here, you know, it just all kind of seems to fit together when officers are out doing their work and they come across someone that maybe has a need that is a little bit more intense or has a need that isn't as basic as, you know, maybe I need a little help with food or I need a little help with housing or maybe I just need somebody to talk to. You know, a lot of people are experiencing mental health issues and it's just not something that they're totally equipped with dealing with. And so having a professional with a mental health background is really helpful.
Are you finding that that's what many of the opportunities that you have to talk to people out there, that maybe the officers have asked for your assistance on the street, so to speak, or maybe during an investigation of some kind, that it's because there's a problem that they feel they can't quite handle, but they know they can get somebody some help?
Sure, absolutely. That is definitely one of them. There are several, but I think for the most part, when I'm engaging with officers on the road, it is definitely mental health issues, domestic violence, sometimes family issues. Mm-hmm. People lose their jobs and they need a little bit of extra help to get them through. And then, of course, on the backside of things, in the investigative portion of it, I'm definitely not a detective, but I assist in any way that I can to try to help the people who are involved with our detective bureau get the help that they need.
Do you think maybe in that particular case, maybe one of the regular investigators on the force might have been talking to people and he's got some information, but maybe want to get a little bit more questions out from somebody they've talked to, and perhaps they turn to you to help come up with some ways to help them?
I think so. You know, it's always better to have two ideas or three ideas or the perspective of somebody who doesn't have a law enforcement background. So,
what seems to be the best way that you've been able to work with the officers here with the Griffith the Police Department? Because it's not a big department, but it's in a community that's very diverse, and I guess they have their share of problems, of wide-ranging problems, I would imagine.
Sure. So I think that the way that I work with them, so I have a background with the Department of Child Services. I'm very familiar with having the social work background and the DCS background, very familiar with the area. I grew up here. I actually grew up in Griffith. So it's helpful for me to know the area, know the demographic, and actually know a lot of the families that have been here for generations. Mm-hmm. It's been very helpful to have the background through the state and working through DCS, understanding the court systems, understanding what is actually out there for families who have needs, and especially kids. Kids are often forgotten sometimes, not just in the world of law enforcement, but in the school arena. I think sometimes people forget that there are children involved in situations, and sometimes they're overlooked. So it's been really good for me to be able to put all of my experience to work, and then with this degree and being able to, really show what I can do.
You mentioned young people. Are there times on occasion that the Griffith Public Schools ask for you to help them out? They may have, of course, specialists or people they turn to on a regular basis, but sometimes they maybe need a little extra help, and do they turn to you, even though you're with the police department?
Well, and so it's funny that you would ask that. I'm actually contracted by the schools to work there 50% of the time. So mm-hmm. I spend three of my work days during the school year, three of my work days during the week at the school. And they certainly do use that knowledge base that I have. So I try to help bridge the gap between outside communities and agencies and the school, improving relationships and better outcomes for our kids.
Give us just an example of a situation where you may be called in. Maybe it's a case where an officer is having some problems out there. He's dealing with somebody at an apartment complex, of which there are several in Griffith, mm-hmm. and you may have some problems, they may have some problems with somebody, and then there's some youngsters that are involved in the mix as well, too. Give us an idea of what sorts of things that you, when you get into a situation and you ask for, they're asked for help, do you find that you have to kind of start first to look at and what steps you tend to take and whatever help you can give?
So I think in a situation like you mentioned, mm-hmm. You're going into a situation with a family who has come into the scope of law enforcement for one reason or another, mm-hmm. Whatever that may be. Because I have access to both the systems and the police department on the law side and at the school, I can kind of check out with those kids, you know, what's going on at school, what's going on at home. It's easier to really identify what a problem can be from a holistic perspective and not just from law enforcement or just from school or just from social work. So I try to piece all those things together like a puzzle to give the family a better picture of what's going on and what we can possibly do to help them.
Yeah. Now, even though you have been involved in many, many cases of certain types, are there any other that you've been able to follow through on that have come up with some very positive and satisfying results?
Yes. In fact, I follow up on quite a few things. And we have one example that I could think of was a gal here in town who was having some domestic violence issues. And we were able to piece together some family members and things that she needed and to get her just out of the situation that she was in and to live with relatives far away. We were able to get her to a safe place very quickly. We were able to put that family piece back in with them. Residents here in town who have come across maybe needing some income or rent assistance, things like that. Something's falling down around them. They're not really sure where to go to get the help and have followed up with people saying, hey, you know, do you remember me? You know, I needed help with my basement that flooded back when the pipes burst in January. Things are going really great. And as you mentioned before, it's a small town. A lot of people know each other, go to church together, work together, their kids go to school together. And so working in the town where I grew up, people grab me quite frequently when I'm out doing things and saying, hey, you helped my so-and-so do this, or you helped my friend do that. You know, so it's really kind of cool to see that.
Are there any ideas or areas that maybe you've kind of conferred with Chief Mance and his other senior officers about that you would like to, if you're not already involved in, that you might like to be involved in over time?
You know, truthfully, there are two things that I really would like to start doing that I haven't had the chance to do because I seem to be busy, a lot busier than I ever imagined I would be. Mm-hmm. One is to develop a wellness or peer support program for our law enforcement officers, which would include current officers, former officers, and retired officers. That community really just, they need the support of each other. And I think in the climate of law enforcement, as what we're seeing across the spectrum with suicide and things of that nature, it's better to get ahead of the problem before it starts or before it presents itself. And the second thing is I would really like to start providing more community trainings, whatever that looks like. Faith-based community is open to having me come and do trainings such as suicide prevention, child protection training, discussing child abuse and neglect, discussing human trafficking, you know, things that do touch our lives, but not everybody really either knows about or wants to talk about. So raising awareness to be able to prevent things from happening is a passion of mine.
Erica, thank you very much for explaining what your job as the social worker for the Griffith Police Department is all about, and I hope that things go well, not only for you, but for the rest of the department into the new year.
Thank you.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.